Good afternoon. This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, November 20th. Let's start with articles from the front page. From Brendan Moore in Decatur, Decatur Council, $96.1 million budget approved for 2025. Gleason calls 2025 plan a transition year. The Decatur City Council on Monday approved City Manager Tim Gleason's 2025 city budget proposal, a $96.1 million spending plan that relies on a new natural gas use tax and a property tax hike to be brought into balance. The general fund budget, which will cover operating expenses such as police, fire, and public works for the next calendar year, includes a 6% increase in spending from the current fiscal year. Some of that spending growth reflects inflationary cost increases, salary bumps guaranteed through new collective bargaining agreements with unions representing city workers, and growing public safety pension costs. But it didn't stop there, as Gleason, who returned for his second stint as the city's top administrator in May, included funding for 15 new positions, including 7 in the chronically understaffed police department and 2 in the fire department. He also is seeking to hire a second deputy city manager. Also included in the budget is a $2.7 million for neighborhood revitalization initiatives in 2025, with more than 3/4 coming from the general fund. Of that, $1.5 million would be earmarked for demolitions. I'm going to be the first one to say it, and I have said this. That's not going to be enough, Gleason said. But we're going to call this 2025 fiscal year a transition year where we're planning on coming up with a larger plan and also continuing to do something because this community expects that. In past years, demolitions and other revitalization efforts were covered through a combination of grants and federal American Rescue Plan stimulus funds. The latter, which helped pad city budgets for the past 3 years, has been completely expended. With this absence of federal stimulus funds and a slowdown in revenue growth from traditional sources like sales taxes, the amount coming into the city left a more than $4 million deficit to be plugged. The vast majority of the shortfall will be made up through a new natural gas use tax approved by the council earlier this month. The tax affects about 200 customers who receive natural gas from companies other than Ameren and don't already pay the city's utility tax. The vast majority of the new tax, perhaps as much as 90%, will be paid by industrial giants Archer Daniels Midland Company and Primient, according to city estimates. The budget hole also will be filled by an increase in the property levy tax levy. After denying city staff's request for a 9% increase earlier this month, the council seemingly settled it on a 7% hike. This would generate about $16.9 million or $1.1 million more than the current year, and it would represent about a $35 annual increase on the tax bills of homes valued at $134,000, the median price in Macon County. The council will not approve the tax levy until December, but the budget includes numbers baking in a 7% increase. However, some council members appeared hesitant to support the increase, instead suggesting a 5% hike. Councilman Dennis Cooper and Chuck Kuhl questioned the need for the new police department positions, considering that staffing for years has been below the approved headcount. However, other council members said the increase, while painful, was necessary to keep up with city services and infrastructure costs. Illinois' tax structure, I think we can all agree, is not one we would champion, said Councilwoman Lisa Gregory. If I recall correctly, in Illinois, we have over 7,000 taxing bodies, and so I understand your frustration because I have to pay that tax bill too. But I'll tell you what, when I turn on my kitchen sink to get a drink of water or when I need to call 911 on the worst day of my life, I want to make sure that as a city we are able to respond to our citizens at a level of service that they expect, she said. Council members also suggested that taxpayers, some of whom registered their disapproval with the tax hike during public comment, take it up with some of the other taxing bodies. The city's share of the property tax levy is only about 16% of the total bill, Area school districts comprise the largest share of the levy, with the Park District, Community College, and others taking slivers as well. Unfortunately, it seems like in the last few years, we have really held the line on our tax increases, and it hasn't stopped the other taxing bodies from jacking theirs up, said Mayor Julie Moore Wolf. They don't follow us, they just pass us up. Gleason told the council that if they ultimately decide to pass a 5% hike, which would reduce the levy by about $315,000, he would hold off on hiring for the new police officer positions until July 1st. The budget vote was 5-2, with Cooper and Councilman David Horn voting against. Horn said the spending plan will fall short in advancing the strategic priorities approved by the council, calling the investment in neighborhood revitalization, for instance, a step backward. The vote on the property tax levy is expected December 2nd. From Scott Perry in Decatur, Decatur Schools, one incumbent among six who have filed for board seats. Six candidates are seeking four spots on the Decatur School Board, and only one of them is an incumbent. Despite indicating last week that she intended to seek re-election, current board member Alana Banks was not among those who filed nomination papers ahead of Monday's deadline. That leaves Jason Dion as the only current board member seeking another term. He will be joined on the ballot by Karen Lauritsen, Tony Albertina, Kevin Hale, Christina Tias, and Devin Martinez-Joyner. The election is April 1st. Board members Al Scheider and Kevin Collins decided against running for re-election, citing new jobs as the primary reason. The filings continue a trend of considerable turnover among board members in the last several years. In 2023, three new board members were seated: Bill Clevenger, who had been appointed in September 22 to fill the seat of retiring longtime board member Dan Oakes, ran and was elected in spring 23. He was joined by Will Wetzel and Mark Reynolds. Both incumbents, Andrew Taylor and Reagan Lewis, chose not to run for re-election that year. In the 21 election, none of the four incumbents sought re-election. In addition to Decatur, the Macon County Clerk's Office reported the following filings for the other county-based districts. In the Argenta-Oriana School District, there are three open seats and only two candidates. Incumbent Corey White is joined on the ballot by Alana Duncan, Don Decker, and Dick Logue didn't file for re-election. In the Moroa-Forsyth School District, incumbents Isaac Zuniga, Matt Crawford, and Jill Feinstein are uncontested in their bid for re-election. In the Meridian School District, there are five candidates for four available seats, and none of them are current board members. The candidates are Nicole Sloniker, Matthew Trimble, Samantha Murray, Jill Parton, and Joseph Lash. Monty Hogan, Chris Jones, Clint Gordon, and Adam Herbert aren't seeking re-election. In the Mount Zion School District, there are four candidates for three available seats. Incumbents Michelle Schumacher and Kyle Jandrin, and being challenged by Marcy Roki and Eric Law. Current board member Nathan Brock isn't seeking re-election. In the Sangamon Valley School District, there are four available seats. Incumbents Joshua Hilbert, Matt Wood, Jessica Browning, and Lori Campbell are being challenged by Tiara Floyd. In the Warrensburg-Latham School District, incumbents Victoria Williams, David Zaski, R.J. McKenzie, and Christopher Wentworth are uncontested in their bid for re-election. Kristen White and Chris have filed to continue their service on the Decatur Park Board. The seats carry with them six-year terms. Our last article from the front page, Federation for Advanced Manufacturing Education, FAME, to help ready workers. We have a photo of Jessica Coleman, a talent acquisition partner at Caterpillar, talks with Bradley Curry of Richland Community College after a press conference for Prairie Land FAME, a new local chapter of the Manufacturing Education Program at Workforce Investment Solutions in Decatur on Monday. This article from Donette Beckett in Decatur. Decatur program to bridge the gap between education and industry. Erica Lynn, human resources business partner with Grain Systems Incorporated, gets plenty of people applying for work in the Assumption plant. But it's difficult to hire qualified candidates, she said. Lynn is confident the new networking group, Prairie Land FAME, will improve the odds of growing the skilled employees they desire. The group is a partnership between Workforce Investment Solutions, Richland Community College, and area manufacturers. Its purpose is to engage high school students and other potential workers and equip them with the experience and skills needed to succeed in a manufacturing workplace. So we're excited to bring this to our plant, Lynn said. Hopefully we can help some people get involved with Richland and get some good qualified candidates in our plant. Over the course of 5 semesters, participants will earn 65 college credit hours and gain 2 years of invaluable work experience through hands-on training with partnering organizations such as Archer Daniels Midlands Company, GSI, Mueller Company, and Vestal Pipe Railway Systems Nortrack. Applications are being accepted until March 31st through the program's website, fame-usa.com. Information about upcoming events, including a family night to learn more about the program, also will be posted. Classes will begin during the fall 2025 semester. We are thrilled to introduce the FAME program to the Decatur community, said Tony Davis, National Director for FAME USA. Our goal is to bridge the gap between education and industry, ensuring that our graduates are not only job ready, but also equipped to drive innovation within the manufacturing sector. The local chapter of FAME, an acronym for Federation for the Advanced Manufacturing Education, is one of 40 chapters throughout the country and the second in Illinois. The program began in 2010 through a partnership with Toyota and the Bluegrass Community and Technical College in Kentucky. Today, FAME is the nation's premier manufacturing education program for students launching new careers or workers learning new skills, and for veterans seeking new careers in manufacturing, said Rocky Wilkerson, Workforce Executive Director. The program will be a pathway to employment with companies in the area. This program will build the next generation of manufacturing professionals here in Macon County and surrounding Central Illinois communities, said Greg Webb, ADM Vice President for State Government Relations. Education will include current manufacturing standards, but stay up to date with industry demands, according to Webb. We will prepare students for the fast-paced, technology-driven environment that meets the needs for today's workforce, he said. According to Lisa Kitchens, ADM Human Resource Manager, manufacturing companies are searching for employees with problem-solving abilities and technical proficiencies. It emphasizes professional qualities and strong work ethics and adaptability, she said, of the FAME program. These are attributes that employers in advanced manufacturing highly value. After being accepted, the students will make a commitment with one of the partnering companies. By mutual selection, we'll fill the positions, Kitchen said. The courses will include robotics, motor controls, occupational safety and health administration, and other disciplines, said John Oliver, Richland's Dean of Workforce Development. It's a 2-year associate's degree, he said. General education classes are incorporated into the classroom instruction. The student must be college ready, according to Oliver. They have to be ready for the 100-level college courses before they start the program, he said. RCC offers various college prep courses. Several are available before the FAME program begins in the next fall semester. Financial obligations are different for each student. Some of the employers may have an opportunity where they have tuition assistance or reimbursement, Kitchen said. There's opportunities for scholarships and grants that will support this program. During the program's work days, the student will be earning a paycheck. With the process, they can ultimately graduate debt-free, Kitchen said. It wasn't that long ago that we were looking for great new jobs, Decatur Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said, but one of the things we haven't had to worry about was the workforce and training them for the future until now. Moore Wolf recognized small big businesses as well as the manufacturing industry have been struggling in recent years. So we welcome this program in Decatur, she said. It's going to be an asset. For more information on Prairie Land FAME program, visit www.fame-usa.com. Applications will be accepted until the end of March. Today's weather: cloudy, breezy, cooler. with a high of 51 and a low of 32. We'll continue now with local and state news from page A3. The Decatur Council Library Pump Station Solar Projects okayed. From Brendan Moore. Quicker than a ray of light, two behind-the-meter solar projects were greenlit by the Decatur City Council this week. The projects will cover the Decatur Public Library's roof and parking lot and the grounds of the William Street Pump Station with solar panels. There would be 1,808 panels at the library site and 320 at the pump station site. They will be owned and maintained by Peoria-based Hawk Atolo LLC, which also owns and maintains the 2,616 solar panels mounted on canopies above the Decatur Civic Center parking lot. The city will also enter into a 15-year power purchase agreement with the company. Over that time, the city estimates saving $1.5 million on energy costs through the library project and the $270,000 through the William Street Array. The privately funded project is expected to cost up to $5 million. The Civic Center solar panels went online earlier this summer. That project, which supplies power to the building, is expected to save the city $1.4 million over the next 15 years. City officials for years have been eyeing opportunities to use public facilities to reduce the city's carbon footprint. The electricity generated by the Civic Center array, for example, is enough to supply power to the facility and even send surplus energy produced during peak summer months back to the grid. Solar panels are also planned for the rooftops of the city's transit facilities, and there have been conversations about the South Water Treatment Plant receiving solar panels. The city is also analyzing the feasibility of adding an additional solar panel-adorned parking canopy at the Civic Center site. The setup in the library parking lot will be similar to that of the Civic Center, with panels mounted on four canopies down the center aisle. The measure is passed unanimously and with no debate. The Millikan University Vespers Concert will be at 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. Saturday, December 7th, and 2 p.m. Sunday, December 8th, at Kirkland Fine Arts Center. The times were incorrect in the story. Tickets for Millikan's Vespers Concert go on sale Tuesday in the Tuesday, November 5th Herald and Review. Now from the money page, Ben Zielinski, Capital News, Illinois, from Chicago. Illinois relief program erases $72 million of medical debt thus far. A state pilot program designed to erase medical debt for 300,000 Illinois residents has already helped thousands eliminate $72 million of debt, the governor's office announced Thursday. The Medical Debt Relief Pilot Program launched on July 1st, the start of the state's 2025 fiscal year. Since then, it has erased debt for 52,745 residents. Residents whose debt has been forgiven so far will receive letters in the mail next week notifying them they no longer carry the debt. The Illinois Medical Debt Relief Pilot Program represents a promise to help families focus on health and recovery without the weight of financial strain, Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a statement. Lawmakers approved $10 million in this year's budget with the goal of eliminating $1 billion of medical debt. The state is partnering with the nonprofit Undue Medical Debt, which can buy debt from collection agencies, hospitals, and similar entities for just a few cents per dollar. Every dollar collected translates into $100 of debt relief by the nonprofit, which partners with governments on debt forgiveness programs. The state's pilot program is modeled off a Cook County program, where the county used $12 million of American Rescue Plan Act funds to forgive debt in partnership with the same nonprofit. Residents who had their debt erased in the initial round of forgiveness had an average of $1,349 of debt, according to the governor's office, with one person holding $242,136 of debt. Illinoisans must meet certain qualifications to be eligible for the program. Residents with a household income at or below 400% of the federal poverty level, or with debt that is 5% or more of their income, can receive forgiveness under the program. Eligible residents do not need to apply for help and will be notified by letters in the mail once their debt has been forgiven. Now from the opinion page, Philip Klinkner, Democrats in disarray. Don't write an obituary for the left just yet. Klinkner is a professor of government at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York. He wrote this for The Conversation. According to the New York Times, a newly triumphant Republican president is once again in the headlines. What will it take to break the present national divide between the narrow but solid Republican majority and a Democratic Party seemingly trapped in second place, asks the Times. That pattern may be hardening into one that will persist for years to come. Perhaps breaking the divide will require an act of God, the Times writes. This isn't a recent take on the 2024 election. The quote comes from 2004, when President George Bush won re-election by 2.4 percentage points, a slightly larger margin than Donald Trump had this year over Kamala Harris in the election results. Of course, none of these predictions came to pass. The supposed enduring Republican majority evaporated as Hurricane Katrina, the ongoing war in Iraq, and the financial crisis caused Bush's popularity to plummet. As a result, Democrats retook the House and the Senate in 2006, and Barack Obama won the presidency in 2008. Despite the lessons of this history, a new round of doomsayers are ready to write the Democrats' obituary in 2024. According to one journalist, Democrats are a lost party. Come January, they'll have scant power in the federal government and shriveling clout in the courts and states. I believe, as the author of a book about how political parties respond to election defeats, and as the example of 2004 shows, it's easy to overstate the enduring impact of an election. Unforeseen events arise that alter the political landscape in unpredictable ways. The party in power often makes mistakes. New candidates emerge to energize and inspire the defeated party. The parties themselves are often incapable of figuring out the best way forward. Following Mitt Romney's loss in the 2012 presidential election, the Republican National Committee commissioned what it called an autopsy to determine how the party should move forward. The report urged Republicans to become more inclusive to women, young people, Asians, Latinos, and gay Americans by softening their tone on immigration and social issues. Nonetheless, in 2016, Donald Trump took the party in exactly the opposite direction and ended up winning anyway. I'd be the last person to try to predict the 2028 election, but I'm skeptical of doom and gloom scenarios for the Democratic Party. First, the 2024 election was extremely close. Once all the votes are counted, it will probably end up being the closest popular vote contest since 2000. In addition, the 2024 results fall pretty close to the outcome predicted by the election models that were based on economic fundamentals. This suggests that voters were registering dissatisfaction with poor economic conditions rather than offering a wholesale rejection of the Democratic ideology. Democrats also should remember that Trump has been a uniquely polarizing and unpopular figure in American politics. Despite a generally strong economy during his first term in office, he was never able to rise above a 50% approval rating. Since Trump can't run again in 2028, that also means Democrats will likely face a better political environment in 2028. Since 1900, the Out Party, the party that doesn't control the White House, has won 8 of the 11 elections without an incumbent president on the ballot. None of this guarantees a Democratic victory in 2028. Nor should the Democrats just assume that everything will be fine. Self-reflection is good for political parties as well as individuals. Still, the lesson of history is that it's a good idea for Democrats to resist the temptation to catastrophize their loss. Instead, they might consider using the Serenity Prayer as a guide for the next 4 years. Give us the serenity to accept the things that can't be changed, the courage to change the things that can be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. And now part two of the opinion page from Francis Wilkinson, who is a Bloomberg columnist, former executive editor for The Week, and writer for Rolling Stone. Party has no easy fix after losing to Trump again. Vice President Kamala Harris led a coalition that stretched from lefty U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat, New York, to former Representative Liz Cheney and her arch-conservative father, Dick Cheney. She campaigned on a vision of lawful, morally decent, multiracial society, where hard work could still secure the American dream, where clean energy would drive a dynamic economy, and where there would be enough to go around for everyone. That broad coalition and optimistic vision raised unprecedented funds. It activated tens of thousands of volunteers who walked precincts, made phone calls, and staffed events. And then it crashed and burned. Every losing campaign is run by dunces, just as every winning campaign is the product of genius. Monday morning quarterbacks who have never worked in a campaign, especially in the fog of right-wing propaganda and disinformation that now permeates and distorts U.S. politics, are rarely convincing. The rough consensus among campaign professionals is that Harris ran a good or better campaign under difficult circumstances. Incumbent parties across the world have struggled and mostly failed to win re-election amid voter anger over the long tail of COVID and inflation. All incumbent parties lost vote share. The notion that another Democrat would have succeeded where Harris failed, or that a different message or coalition emphasis would have swayed voters attracted to Trump, seems spurious at best. The country moved in lockstep to the right. The shift from blue to red was generally less pronounced in the seven swing states that once again commanded the vast majority of campaign resources and attention. Harris fared worse in places like New York City, which shifted 17 percentage points to the right, and some California counties that flipped from Democratic to Republican. Ultimately, voters had a clear choice. The race was a hard contest between hope and fear, with the fear conveyed via Trump's signature demagogy. Harris failed to convince voters of something fundamental, that there is enough to go around. Her vision of a positive future for all crashed against Trump's claims that the pie is shrinking and you'd best get yours before an immigrant or a trans kid steals it. Democrats often struggle to win against that argument. Historically, they operate on a theory that all deserve some and that American society is rich enough to provide it. Fear of resource scarcity, by contrast, is a bulwark of conservative politics the world over. Exit polls, which are inexact, can only tell us so much about the motivations of Hispanic men, a majority of whom appear to have voted for Trump. Perhaps Harris could have better appealed to their sense of economic insecurity or status threat. Or perhaps those men figured that in a racially polarized society, in which brown and black immigrants were being scapegoated daily, it was better to latch on to the white guy than the black woman. The party of Happy Days Are Here Again will soon adopt a darker message of its own. Social Security, Medicare, and Obamacare are all at high risk in a Trump administration. The politics of fear will likely mutate in the months ahead. How Democrats organize and broadcast that message remains to be seen. With Republicans in control of the White House, Senate, House, and Supreme Court, Democrats will not have a power base in Washington. That leaves California Governor Gavin Newsom as the probable leader of the party in exile. Newsom will likely be testing new messages to suit a new role. Realistically, Democrats may have to wait for another catastrophe under a GOP president. Yet Trump's mismanagement of COVID, in which he flooded the public sphere with lies and misinformation, did not foreclose his comeback any more than his open criminality did. We will soon be living not under a new presidency so much as a new system of government. It's unclear what exactly it will be, but much is evident. Malice and stupidity will be its twin pillars. The rule of law and democracy will not. Today in history. On November 20th, 1910, Francisco Madero led a revolt against Mexican President Porfirio Diaz, marking the beginning of the decade-long Mexican Revolution. On this date in 1945, 22 former Nazi officials went on trial before an international war crimes tribunal in Nuremberg, Germany. Almost a year later, the International Military Tribune sentenced 12 of the defendants to death. Seven received prison sentences ranging from 10 years to life. Three were acquitted. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, November 20th. Please stay tuned.